So here we are today with Sophia Lane. She is running for Cabrillo Unified School District, and this will be her second time running. I interviewed her 4 years ago when she was running for her first time, and here we are again. And today I'd like to start with funding. As somebody who used to be a teacher back in 89 here at CUNA, in fact, I've seen funding problems at the state and the federal level. I do not see it as a COSD bad management, bad budgeting, or anything like that. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Did not realize I was going to be spending so much time on 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And has taken definitely a lot of effort to get informed on and accept a lot of the challenges that are at play with regards to public school funding in California. And there really is a public school funding issue in California where we, you know, bottom line, we end up being around 41st in terms of per pupil funding across the country. And that's for a number of reasons. Essentially, I think it's really important to know that local property taxes really drive the amount of funding that California schools get in the K-12 level. And that ends up being very inequitable across the state.
Well, right. I mean, all neighborhoods are not equal.
Yeah. I'll say systemic racism mm-hmm. is definitely a factor here mm-hmm. because the formulas really are, you know, heavily based on local property taxes. So, you know, there are some adjustments for districts based on their number of pupils and pupils at different levels and students of certain categories, if you will, like they're learning English or they're homeless, you know, mm-hmm. or they're low income. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, maybe 20% or so adjustment for that, sometimes more if you have a high concentration of those. But fundamentally, the property taxes drive the revenues. And so that leads to inequities not only across the state, but even within a county, and especially when you're in a high cost of living county like San Mateo, the per pupil funding among districts can vary, you know, by up to almost threefold.
So yeah, well, we have what 11,000-12,000 per pupil here.
Yep.
And then Woodside is 25,000.
Yep. So neighboring school district with fewer students of color and fewer students low income, fewer students learning English. Elementary school age students, and you know, more power to Woodside. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for them. They
sure.
have the infrastructure and the rules and the funding that they can support their kids that they, you know, the way they should be. Mm-hmm. But it really leaves districts that, like ours, at a disadvantage.
Well, I know, but when you look at that $15,000 difference, I mean, this is, we're not even close to solving the problem, barely even addressing it. How do you think CUSD is going to deal with? I know there's some conflicts with the union and the district in terms of coming to terms with the contract. There's no money. So how is that going to get resolved? And how, as we move forward over the next 4 years, what kind of funding strategies is CUSD going to use within their limited ability to do anything?
Yeah. So big picture, I mean, just like any struggling family, family mm-hmm. that's struggling with their finances, mm-hmm. a school district or any other government agency organization, the first step really is to stabilize your finances. Mm-hmm. And when you're like on the verge of bankruptcy, say, for instance, which is analogous to the situation we were in last year mm-hmm. when we, you know, faced and made $2 million in budget cuts to be able to maintain local control of our district.
Yeah, to be clear, the county wants to take over the CUSD if we don't have our budgetary act
right,
together.
Like that's always the rule across the
yeah,
state.
Right.
Like if you can't keep your act together, your county takes over and you lose right. control. You have to take expensive loans. It's not somewhere you want to be for sure. There's no like someone comes in and cleans everything up and you're better for it.
No,
it's you end up like
right.
Oakland, you know, a decade later still mm-hmm. paying high interest loans.
Yep.
So, and having somebody else come in and, you know, tell you how you're going to do
so. So the number one goal that CUSD has is to avoid being taken over by the county.
That's the first step.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the first step. And so that was the step last year where we undertook that, big budget cut exercise, along with renewing very conservatively our parcel tax measure. And so that was in the interest of stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
So first you got to like stem the bleed,
yeah.
put on the tourniquet, you stop bleeding.
Right, triage.
Triage, like right. And then the next step now is kind of now you start into mid-range and longer range planning where you start to kind of like, okay, you cut the lower hanging fruit, if you will. And now you start to look again at two main numbers when you're looking at budgeting and finances moving forward. You have to look at what are your revenues and what are your expenses. Your reserves give you a little bit of cushion as long as you have them. And we're very fortunate because we got a little bit of a bump in our revenues last year because we flipped status, funding status, which is a very weird thing. But you, when you flip the status, you get a chunk of money. So we got that chunk of money, which gave us a little bit of a buffer and not having to make cuts this year. It was one-time funding. And so looking at being able to spend more money on an ongoing basis, we need to align those other two numbers, the revenues and the expenditures, so that they're more in line. And in fact, right now in our forecast for this year and the coming 2 years, our revenues still are less than our expenditures, meaning we're spending more money than we're bringing in this year, next year, and the year after that.
Correct.
This year, that number is about $2.5 million. So just when we think about that number, that's a really big number that we're spending $2.5 million more than we're bringing in this year.
And the QSD budget is around $40 million, is that correct?
Yeah, it's around like 35-ish million. Gotcha. Yeah, it kind of fluctuates each year a little bit. And has over the last couple of years. So that's really important. Next year, again, that gap is a little bit less because we're expected to flip status again next year. So it's we're extremely fortunate that's happening because that every time we flip, it's like a little bit of a bonus. And that's not a normal thing. That's just because we're kind of hovering in that line between being state funded and community funded.
Right. Yeah. It's a percentage of Latino population or ESL population. Does that have anything to do with it?
We're 53%. It's part of it. Part of it, but it's not directly that. It's basically that we can, when you exceed the minimum spending amount for each student in terms of your property tax relative to your student population, like just simple numbers, then you get to keep the rest.
And so we're
like, you might consider like poor community funded.
Yes.
Like it's kind of like we're off food stamps. We were off food stamps last year, but then we didn't get the benefit of the food stamps. So this year we're back on food stamps.
Okay.
Next year we're expecting to be, because we're getting more benefits of being on food stamps this year, we're going to be back to not being on food stamps next year. If that makes sense.
Given California education, that makes sense.
Yes. It's just like I said, just like any family that's struggling with their own finances when they're hovering at that poverty line and you're jumping in and out, and this year you have benefits, next year we won't. And so, you know, we get a bump of money that helps us next year, but not the year after that. We won't get that one-time funding. So, you know, really to have any kind of sustained expenditures, like, you know, increased employee costs, for example, that are recurring costs, you have levers, of course, you could do one-time funding for employee, you know, expenditures as well. But when we're talking about recurring employee costs, you need to make sure that you have recurring revenues
right.
to cover that. Otherwise, you're just adding to your expenditures without adding to your revenues, and you're making a problem that already right now we're forecasting year after next, we're going to be again back in the red by $800,000 based on current estimates, and these things change. However, we're in a very interesting environment right now with COVID and the pandemic and, you know, presidential election coming up. It's hard to predict
what's going
to
happen.
There's not a lot of reason to be particularly optimistic right now, mainly because there's just a lot of unknowns.
Well, one of the unknown knowns is our student population. So I know our population is going down, which means your ADA is going down, which is how you funded. If your student doesn't show up at school, you don't get paid for that student.
Right, when you're state funded. And so
what's the difference with your community funded?
Sorry, guys,
we're going deep here. You gotta understand this.
I know, and I definitely want to recommend folks too, if they want visuals around this too. We have the district has on their website a series of talks that I had done with Dr. McFetridge last fall to explain how public school funding works from the very beginning. So those are useful videos.
Okay.
One of the reasons we are flipping status and haven't stayed state funding is because that ratio of revenues to enrollment has gotten more quote-unquote favorable in terms of, like, the property tax income keeps going up a little bit each mm-hmm. year. You know, Prop 13 aside, any new home that sells gets reassessed and we get that incremental revenue each year. Of revenues to student number changes. When you have fewer student numbers and the same or higher overall revenues, then that's more favorable in terms of the revenues per student. That's one of the reasons where we've been flipping back and forth is our property tax revenues have been going up a little bit each year, but our enrollment numbers, just like the vast majority of districts in the county, in the region, in the state for that matter, have been generally declining.
Right.
So it's just getting really expensive to live in California. Yeah. We're losing young kids.
Yeah.
And not that we're losing them, they're just not being born here.
Yes.
They're not moving here because it's really hard for a young family to live in the Bay Area anymore.
In fact, the population's going down so much that we have two elementary schools that, you know, need to be remodeled. We may only remodel one.
Yep, we're going to have to look at that.
Yeah.
We're going to have to look at that. And that's exactly why when you're looking at, you know, being financially responsible and spending tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money, we can't look for the quick fix that makes people happy.
Right.
Like, you know, painful as it is, and a lot of what we do as a board, because it is so long-term focused, can be very painful. But we have to really look at, you know, what buildings are we going to need in the future? Not today. What do we have today, and what do we want to replace today?
Yeah.
But what are we going to need moving forward?
And for the audience, just to note, we're talking about capital expenditures versus employee costs.
Yes.
And they're funded differently. So that's a very important thing to
That's
note.
Really important.
Right.
Yeah, because there are different ways that school districts need to manage their funds based on the source of those funds and the use of those funds.
That's right. So we passed a bond for capital infrastructure recently.
Yep.
Would it be of a possibility to pass another bond for employee salary money? Is there an angle there at all?
We could, and that would be one of the things as we look to stabilize. So as I talked earlier about, like, figuring out how do you get those two numbers, your revenues and expenditures. Like, your revenues need to be at least as much as your expenditures, ideally a little bit more, so that you accumulate some kind of reserve so that when you have incidents come up or changes that are unexpected, you can weather those, right? It's just like as a family, if you have nothing in your savings account and somebody, God forbid, gets sick or somebody loses their job, it's like you're in big trouble. You're having to make decisions that are not good. But if you have a little bit of a buffer, you can ride those storms and still stay pretty healthy. So it's kind of like, you know, you don't want to have to make $2 million in cuts all of a sudden.
Right.
That is not ideal. But if you have some time to plan for $800,000 in cuts 2 years out, it's like not ideal, but much more manageable.
Right. Well, you got to deal with
time.
It.
Yeah.
You deal with it,
exactly. So. You got to deal with it. It's just better to be able to deal with it like 2 years ahead than like 2 months ahead.
So now I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. If in your ideal world, how would you fund Californian schools?
Yes. So you would so California, I would change the local control funding formula. And I would probably shift from having three tiers of funding, which is your basic funding, your supplemental funding, which is essentially per student that fits in certain categories I mentioned earlier, English learners or low socioeconomic status, et cetera. Getting, you know, we get 20%, you know, extra, if you will, for that, or we're required to spend 20% extra, if you will, for those students. And then there's a concentration funding, which is kind of a bolus of money if you get when more than 55% of your students fit that category. So for that incremental number.
Do we get that?
We don't get that because we're just shy of that 55%.
Oh, that's right. We're 53%.
About typically around like 47, something like that.
Oh, yeah, it's gone just down around a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. It's hovering close to 50.
Okay.
So needless to say, it's just shy of that 55%. So kind of like a weird threshold that like above it, yes, there you are generally more taxed, but just below it, you're not necessarily more taxed. I mean, not taxed in terms of money, taxed in terms of stressed and strained and even needless extra support. So I would really, like, the real solution is fixed local control funding formula so that you have, I would say, more of a linear progression. It also is problematic that local control funding formula sets funding levels for school districts and, you know, based on their demographics, you know, informed by their property tax revenues, regardless of where you are in the state. Mm-hmm. So with our demographic population, if we were in Bakersfield, mm-hmm. which is a much lower cost of living area mm-hmm. of the state, we would get the same amount of money.
Okay.
It costs a lot less to
live there.
Gotcha. You know, your employees, mm-hmm. you know, don't need to earn quite as much to live a comfortable life there.
Yeah.
And that's part of the strain with many state jobs work this way too. So it's not just schools, but it is problematic. So ideally having some geographic cost of living adjustment would be good.
Right.
You know, those are two things that could contribute to basically, like, we just need that base grant. We just need the total spending per pupil target to be higher
mm-hmm.
so that if we were below that, which, you know, if it was higher, we would almost certainly be below it because we're always just hovering at it,
mm-hmm.
Then we could get more state funding.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any predictions with COVID and everything, you know, people moving in and out of town, that the population percentage will go up, down relative to?
It's hard to say at this relatively early stage. I haven't heard qualitatively of major movement, but I know mm-hmm. many families are really, really strained right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wouldn't be surprised if over the course of the year, we lose families from the Bay Area more than we had, you know, at a faster rate, if you will, than we had in the past.
Yeah, that's my thinking.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think until, you know, all these, and COVID really does add an additional element of strain right now because, you know, those arguments for fixing LCFF right now in a mm-hmm. in a cash-strapped state that has fortunately had a rainy day fund to draw upon,
mm-hmm.
but really after the budgeting season last spring ended up in a, you know, in a bind itself. So there's not a lot of wiggle room.
There's not a solution from the state.
Yeah, there's not, because they're been pretty depleted mm-hmm. with a lot of the expenditures they've had and the lack of revenues. So even bigger picture, if you humor me for just a minute, is one of the challenges at the state level, bigger picture beyond school funding, is the budget model for the state in terms of its heavy reliance on income taxes as its revenues. So it's proportionately, we're very, very reliant on income tax, which sounds great and is great in ways because you can kind of, you know, have certain tax schemes that tax people that get more money, that mm-hmm. have more income.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that as a state. However, income fluctuates a lot year to year, mm-hmm. which means, again, as I was saying earlier, if you're managing your, mm-hmm. your financials properly, mm-hmm. you say, well, just like if you have a salary with a bonus, you say, I don't know if I'm going to get my bonus every mm-hmm. year, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to like spend it before I have it. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a little bit more conservative a reserve mm-hmm. practice, so which is what the state does. But that means you can't spend the money even when you have it. And so mm-hmm. you don't have that kind of steady flow of income that other states do. Which would really enable us to have more regular spending and not feel like we have to keep it in reserve. So one way to do that, really what the other revenue source that other states rely on is property taxes. So this gets to the whole thing back to Prop 13.
So it is
in
a balance
70s.
Between income tax and property tax.
Yeah, those are the two typical like big sources of revenue for most states. And so we're fortunate we have a strong economy mm-hmm. here, so we mm-hmm. get corporate tax.
Mm-hmm.
But then the corporate taxes still get affected by economic recessions and stuff.
Sure.
So in general, property taxes are like, they never go down. Like they, mm-hmm. you know, Prop 13 changed things a lot for the state mm-hmm. in that they didn't go up as much with the mm-hmm. rationale, which is very valid, to say we don't want residents to be priced out of their homes because of their taxes,
mm-hmm.
because the home values were appreciating so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a cap put on back in the 70s, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's like 2% a year mm-hmm. is what your property tax can increase a year. You
mm-hmm.
don't get reassessed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get reassessed when you pass it to your children either.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a proposition on the ballot for this November, which I think is a good one, which is Prop 15. It's often called
mm-hmm.
the split roll.
Mm-hmm.
And that would essentially allow the state to have a different mechanism for residential properties versus commercial. So leave residential exactly the same as it is, not touch it. But it would look at reassessing every so often the commercial properties so that the...
On the point of sale?
Every so often, even after the point of sale.
Oh.
So you would get the point of sale just like you do for residential, but also every, I don't remember the details, every few years, you know, plus or minus, you'll get reassessed, and therefore, you know, your tax bill will go up for a corporation. Not for small businesses, and there's a lot of complexity around how they define that, but in general, I think, again, I don't remember off the numbers off the top of my head, but it's the large proportion of, you know, the billions of dollars that they would bring in from adjusting that tax model. It's really targeting the larger corporations that tend to hold their properties for a long time. So if you're Disney, if you're Intel, if you're my former employer Genentech, you own your properties for decades and decades and decades, and, you know, because you're there, right? You don't really like move around like residents, residential property owners do, and so they benefit from that 1970s Prop 13 in terms of, you know, paying 1970s rates if you've been there from 1970. So I think that's the idea, is to have corporations pay their fair share.
So it won't really affect the coast side too much, but it will affect the state.
It will definitely bring the state. If Prop 15 passes, we would phase into another $1.9 million a year. That would be amazing.
That's a good fact. So
it's, we'll see what happens, because
well, that is a certain, that's certainly a very good effect then.
That would be an amazing effect. You know, the polls I've been reading so far, Prop 15 is a little bit, it's not obvious that it's going to pass this fall. So it's, I think, polling at less than 50% so far. So it's, you know, with some undecided voters. So, you know, we don't know how it's going to go, but it's, if it does, that'll be amazing. If not, I think we're going to have to look at continually, you know, further rounds of cost efficiencies. I think we're going to need to look at, you know, revisit our parcel tax. Right now it stands at a flat 150, which is the rate we've had for 10 years, which is, doesn't actually even make sense. And parcel taxes really are a mechanism that generally higher cost of living areas will see in their districts as a kind of a band-aid. It's not the right, it's not the true solution.
they're taking a tree down
some
nearby.
Some kind of construction, sounds like a grinder. So parcel taxes really are a band-aid, parcel tax measures, because you know, when you have this high cost of living and your state funding levels are not sufficient, you know, many, if not most, I would say Bay Area districts have them. Some, like Menlo Park, have I think upwards of about $1,000 a year per parcel.
And
Menlo Park is obviously a very different community, but ours at 150 is on the lower side. So I think that's something that we would need to look at and see, and see if we can, you know, maybe how our community would feel about doing a replacement. Maybe, you know, that's maybe not flat for all homes, but I don't see why we wouldn't have a more equitable way of seeking support from a community that's like a progressive tax that's based on square footage, say, of your home. Big homes pay more than little homes. Kind of makes
that,
sense.
That does, that does make sense.
How regular property taxes work too. And it's, again, back to like kind of having an equitable thing where you know, people can contribute accordingly.
That's a good angle, Sophia. I like it.
So that's another possibility of something that we could look at on that revenue side. So Prop 15 would be the first step. Like, if that passes, and that's a long shot right now, we will be singing in the streets. Because you know, as it phases in, like I said, about estimated to be about $1.9 million a year. So we'll be very happy. You know, otherwise, we continue, you know, we will be convening a financial advisory committee, and I'm really thrilled to be looking forward to participating on that with Mary Beth Alexander. And we'll be working with the district staff and community members, and ultimately bringing, you know, recommendations to the board on how to solve this gap, this budget gap that we have. So community input is going to be the key. We're working towards it. And that's the bottom line, that I think that, like, every single thing that we do, like, we need to work together. Like, we are in crisis right now because of our finances. We're in you know, crisis right now because of COVID and all the ancillary, you know, important things that have come up with it. But it's really up to us, each one of us, every single day, to make that choice. Are we going to work together? Or are we going to, you know, not.
And and if you have questions, Sophia has an open door policy. I'll include her email.
Very open
so
door.
That
I'll
you
talk
can,
to anyone.
You'll talk
for
to
sure.
anyone yeah. as long as
any
you
political
can.
Affiliation, right. any background, you know, whatever it is. And I think that's something that I've appreciated over the years too, is, you know, being able to talk to whoever is interested, ask me a question, and
that's right.
I may or may not have the answer you want, but I'll
you'll find it.
You'll give you the truth.
That's right.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I'll listen too, and that's important, you know.
Right.
And that's how we move forward. Is we don't move forward, you know, stepping on each other. We move forward together, and that's what my hope is for our community at this really challenging point in time. Is that we do that.
That's cool. Now, we've gone long here, but I do want to just spend maybe 5 minutes on the future of the classroom. What are your thoughts? I mean, we've got people who are bubbling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm assuming you're still collecting ADA because they're still mm-hmm. tuning into their classrooms mm-hmm. and stuff like that. That's right?
Yep.
Okay. So if you have some of the more affluent people bubbling, mm-hmm. will it make it better for the people who are less affluent to be able to come into the schools? Because a lot of people will be out of the schools. Is mm-hmm. is that a good thing? Is the bubbling a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see that evolving over the next year?
So I think the disruption that we have had as a result of the pandemic is very, very challenging in many different ways. I think that said, sometimes disruptions really cause mm-hmm. you to kind of relook at what you're doing and how you're doing it. It's kind of that shake. It's like an earthquake, right? Like
mm-hmm.
physically, like, you know, literally shake, you know? And so you kind of look at things in a different way. So essentially what it's forced us to do is kind of flip our model of bringing students to education
mm-hmm.
to bring education to our students.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, literally we're doing that,
yeah.
bringing it to their,
uh-huh.
you know, giving them a computer if they need it, bringing
yep.
it to their homes or wherever they're working from. And that's where their education is. It's like literally where they are, because no one's on campus right now
right.
in terms of, you know, our students. So I think in that regard, it's a, you know, we have a lot of opportunities to look at what we're doing and how we're doing it. So I don't know what the answer is going to be in terms of like how we phase back in, but I can say I'm supportive that the district right now is looking at how to start phasing in small groups of students based on their most urgent, important needs.
Right.
So, you know, particularly exploring groups, you know, students who have special educational needs first and
mm-hmm.
foremost
mm-hmm.
to say that's really hard when you're home,
mm-hmm.
you know, particularly certain needs. How do we explore bringing them back on campus and really prioritizing them? So the key is like we got to do it together, right? We got to be open to what are the possibilities. We got to dream those possibilities.
Yes.
You know, and
yep.
let go of the past and imagine the future
mm-hmm.
and just figure out what's in our way.
Yep, exactly.
And like let's get it work together, lift those boulders and move forward.
Make it happen.
Yep.
Well, Sophia, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
You too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye,
Take care.
Wood chopper.
Bye, wood chopper. Good luck with that wood chopping.